The content of this program are intended for a print and media and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine, North Carolina History for Students. Today from the spring 2019 edition, volume 58, number 2, which is called The 1960s, How Does Change Happen? And the first article today will be Vietnam, The War in Our Living Room by Charlie Knight, who is curator of military history at the North Carolina Museum of History. In today's society, news is literally at our fingertips on our smartphones, but that was not always the case. Before the 1930s, people learned the news by reading newspapers and magazines or by talking to others. By World War II, radio became a major news source. Families gathered to listen to a variety of radio broadcasts, from news to entertainment. Television gradually replaced radio and print media as the main source of information and entertainment during the 1950s and 1960s. The Vietnam War was the first to be fought in the era of television. Reporters and camera crews were on the ground with the troops in Southeast Asia, and they sent vivid images and descriptions of what they experienced to those at home. Never before had any conflict been brought into the living room, giving people back home an up-close look at the fighting. This had a huge impact on public opinion of the war. The war began in the 1950s as a struggle over control of Vietnam, a former French colony. The Soviet Union, China, and others backed Ho Chi Minh, the communist leader of North Vietnam. The United States, Great Britain, Australia, and several other countries sided with the democratic government of South Vietnam. Neither side was willing for the other to take control of the country. That led to war. At first, the United States sent advisors to assist the South Vietnamese military. But as the fighting grew in size and scope, so did the number of American advisors in Vietnam. In August 1964, North Vietnamese ships attacked a United States Navy ship off of the Vietnamese coast. This led to President Lyndon B. Johnson sending American troops to fight in Vietnam. But Vietnam was not like other conflicts the United States had waged before. In Vietnam, there were no front lines. Attacks were just as likely and deadly in the cities as they were in the jungles and rice paddies. Often it was unclear who the enemy was. Villagers who seemed friendly sometimes turned out to be enemy soldiers. Many Americans were unclear why exactly the United States was involved in the war. To have enough men in uniform to maintain the war in Vietnam, the government turned to the draft, randomly selecting young men age 18 and up to join the military. Plus, the images and reports on TV from Vietnam sometimes seemed to show that the war was not going as well as the government said it was. All these factors made the war increasingly unpopular. But it was perhaps the television reports that had the largest impact. In August 1965, CBS aired a report by Morley Safer about United States Marines burning the village of Cam Nay. The village was thought to be an enemy hideout because several Marines had been wounded there earlier. But that was not made clear in the TV report. It became one of the most controversial news stories about the war, and changed both how the war was fought and how it was reported. 3 years later, CBS anchorman Walter Cronkite presented a special report based on his time in Vietnam. He did not think victory was possible based on the recent fighting he had observed. Who won and who lost in the Great Tet Offensive? I'm not sure. The Viet Cong did not win by a knockout, but neither did we. It seems now more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate. But it is increasingly clear to this reporter that the only rational way out then will be to negotiate, not as victors, but as an honorable people who lived up to their pledge to defend democracy and did the best they could. President Johnson decided not to seek re-election in 1968. Beginning in 1969, the American presence in Vietnam grew smaller. In early 1973, the last United States combat soldiers withdrew from Vietnam, but the war continued for another 2 years. In late April 1975, North Vietnamese troops captured the South Vietnamese capital city, Saigon, all but ending the war. It was a defeat for the South Vietnamese and, by extension, a defeat for the United States. Many were left wondering, what had all these young men died for? Almost 3 million Americans served in Vietnam. 58,220 of them were killed. North Carolina sent more than 216,000 men and women to Vietnam. About 1,600 died. Many of those who went to Vietnam trained in North Carolina, at Fort Bragg, Camp Lejeune, Cherry Point, and Pope Air Force Base. Thanks to the brave reporters, cameramen, and other journalists who went to the war zone, the Vietnam War is one of the most documented wars in history. Longtime CBS reporter Dan Rather said of his time in Vietnam, "I felt honored to cover American men and women in combat in Vietnam. Because what everyone may think of the war, it may have been the wrong war in the wrong place at the wrong time for the wrong reasons, but the Americans who went there for the right reason. They went there because they loved their country and their country had asked them to go." Since Vietnam, historians have continued to debate how media coverage affected the war and how its soldiers were seen when they returned home. In the wars that followed, Desert Storm, Iraq, Afghanistan, the United States government knew it had to win the war on two fronts, on the battlefield and in how the media covered these conflicts. Here are the captions for the accompanying photographs. Photo by Mike Callahan, U.S. Army, 1969. I think this photograph was taken on Christmas Day of 1969. They did bring in hot food, turkey and dressing and cranberry sauce and all that. They tried to be as good to us as they could over there. TV reporter Walter Cronkite, with microphone, interviews the commanding officer of the 1st Battalion, 1st Marines, during the Battle of Hue City, February 1968. Photo by Gerald Harrison, United States Army, 1970. This is a typical scene you would see along the roadside. Individuals who had water buffaloes were considered to be very wealthy. These animals would have been used to pull plows in rice farming. A man and a woman watched footage of the Vietnam War on television in their living room, February 13, 1968. Vietnam is a country in Southeast Asia, population 97,028,170 as of 2019. In the 1950s, the country was divided into North Vietnam and South Vietnam. In 1975, at the end of the war, Vietnam was again unified into one country under a communist government. People gather at a 1966 rally to support President Lyndon B. Johnson and his policies on the war. Anti-war activists protest outside the White House in 1968. Photo by Gerald Harrison, U.S. Army, 1970. This represents a typical couple of kids on a sampan boat. It was surprising they were very gentle kids in spite of the war. This one looks like she's seen a lot for her age. I would say that Sampan Alley was a pretty tough place to grow up. Agony. Agony of war. Desperation. This is not the thing that the military or the media would really publish. Robert Carica. Carriker, U.S. Army, 1969. Photo by David Prevett, U.S. Navy, 1968. You can say, man, this guy's having a good time. But a little background on that. I'm sitting in this gun tub. I'm a front gunner. These gun turrets on these things would probably hold 2,000 to 2,500 shells. Coming back from Vietnam, I have never, ever, ever been able to hold a weapon or hunt. I'm glad that picture was taken, but it's got kind of those mixed feelings about it. And photo by Dale Daub, U.S. Army, 1967. We were guarding a bridge near Duck Foe. There was a young kid out of the village over in the lower left. He was probably 8, 9, maybe 10, full of energy. He'd come up, we'd give him food or rations or whatever we had. Whenever something was going to happen, he would come and stay with us. And nothing would happen to our bridge, but other bridges down the road would be booby-trapped. Next article, Young People and the Civil Rights Movement by Watson Jennison, who is an associate professor of history at the University of North Carolina in Greensboro. What do you know about the Civil Rights Movement? Maybe you've learned about great leaders such as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Rosa Parks. That makes sense since they played important roles in the history of civil rights. But the movement would not have achieved its success without everyday people like you and me, who joined the many boycotts and marches that led to the dismantling of the Jim Crow South. Did you know that many of those activists were young people? And much of that history happened right here in North Carolina. Before we continue with the rest of the article, I'm going to read a sidebar, which includes some words to look for in their definitions. Civil rights. The legal promise to be treated equally regardless of one's sex, race, religion, etc. Jim Crow, the unfair treatment of black people in the South when laws were passed that did not give them the same rights as white people. Segregation, the practice or policy of keeping people of different races, religions, etc. separate from each other. Discrimination, the practice of unfairly treating a person or group of people different from others. And disenfranchisement, the effort to prevent a person or group of people from having the right to vote. Now we'll continue the article. In 1960, four 17-year-old friends decided to take a stand against segregation and racial injustice. They wanted to protest the laws that did not allow African Americans and white people to eat together in the same restaurant. These students were freshmen at the Agricultural and Technical College, now North Carolina A&T State University. Franklin McCain, Joseph McNeil, David Richmond, and Ezel Blair Jr., who changed his name to Jibril Kazan in 1968. On February 1st, the students went to the F.W. Woolworth's dime store in downtown Greensboro and purchased several items, including school supplies. Then they sat down at the whites-only lunch counter and tried to order. The white employees refused to serve them. Instead of leaving, the young men stayed in their seats until the store closed. The next day, the students returned to Woolworth's and sat down at the counter again. But this time, they were joined by other students, including women from nearby Bennett College, one of two historically black women's colleges in the nation. Within a month, the protest grew into a movement, as sit-ins spread first to other cities in North Carolina and then throughout the South. Seizing the initiative, young black men and women pressed their demands for an end to racial discrimination. The Greensboro sit-ins marked the start of an important new phase in the civil rights movement. Through their collective efforts, young African Americans drew attention to the hypocrisy of segregation and indignities faced by black Southerners on a daily basis. Their protests reflected their anger with the racist system as well as their impatience with the slow pace of social change. Only a few years before, the movement had achieved major victories through the landmark decision in the 1954 Brown versus the Board of Education case and the Montgomery bus boycott the year after. But the years that followed brought fewer breakthroughs, so young black men and women embraced different methods to achieve racial equality, which challenged the movement's older leadership in the process. Some of these African-American leaders were initially skeptical of the sit-ins when they began, but most came to support them eventually. Ella Baker, the executive director of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC, and a longtime activist, hoped to build off the momentum of the student protests. She organized a conference in April 1960 in Raleigh to bring young activists together to discuss plans to move forward. Convened at Baker's alma mater, Shaw University, the meeting drew 120 student activists from more than 50 black colleges and high schools from 12 different states. Baker was joined by Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., who helped pay for the meeting. But beyond offering words of support, they and the other adults present largely encouraged the young people to make their own decisions. By the end of the conference, the students founded the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, pronounced SNCC. In the decade that followed, SNCC emerged as a powerful force in the civil rights movement, and many of its young leaders gained widespread renown. SNCC activists were involved in many of the most important campaigns in the struggle against Jim Crow in the 1960s. They joined the Freedom Rides in 1961, which challenged segregation on interstate buses in the South. They helped organize the March on Washington in 1963, which included a speech delivered by the chairman of SNCC, John Lewis. Today, Lewis serves as a congressman from Georgia in the United States House of Representatives. And in 1965, they joined the protest at the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, known as Bloody Sunday. In the beginning, SNCC activists focused their efforts on direct action protests like the sit-ins and marches, but soon they broadened their approach to include voter registration drives and political organizing. In the 1960s, black men and women throughout the South were prohibited from voting because of disenfranchisement laws passed by state governments in the late 1800s and early 1900s. SNCC activists moved into African-American communities across the region to help local organizers establish freedom schools. They promoted literacy campaigns to help black citizens qualify to vote and to participate in the electoral process. These efforts culminated in the Freedom Summer of 1964 and the creation of the Mississippi Freedom and Democratic Party, and contributed to the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965, which removed many of the restrictions that had prevented African Americans from voting. Young activists brought a fierce urgency to the black freedom struggle when they assumed a leading role beginning in the 1960s. Rather than holding them back, the students' youthful exuberance and inexperience enabled them to see new possibilities and embrace new strategies that adults could not imagine. Their vision and activism made the seemingly impossible possible. Here are some photograph captions. A rare photo of the first organizational meeting of SNCC at Shaw University in Raleigh, April 1960. The meeting drew 120 student activists from more than 50 black colleges and high schools from 12 different states. Students peacefully sit in to order at a segregated lunch counter in Raleigh in 1960, even though servers have tried to shoo them away by placing a closed sign on the counter. Today, you can visit the historical site of the 1960 lunch counter sit-ins in Greensboro, which is now the International Civil Rights Center and Museum. The four students, known as the Greensboro Four, which sparked the sit-in protest across North Carolina and throughout the South, David Richmond, Franklin McCain, Ezell Blair Jr., now Jabril Kazan, and Joseph McNeil. And there are two sidebar articles. The first one is about Ella Baker. Give light and people will find the way. Ella Baker, born in 1903 and died in 1986, was an activist who played a major role in the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s. Born in Norfolk, Virginia, she grew up in Littleton, North Carolina. Baker went to boarding school and then college at Shaw University in Raleigh and graduated in 1927 as valedictorian. She went on to work with major civil rights organizations, including the NAACP, SCLC, In Friendship, and SNCC. Her generous work earned her the nickname Fundi, a Swahili word meaning a person who teaches a craft to the next generation. And the second sidebar article, I Have a Dream in Rocky Mount. A defining moment in the civil rights movement was a speech given by Dr. Martin Luther King at the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom on August 29, 1963. He stood on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial before a crowd of 250,000 people and gave what has become known as the I Have a Dream speech. It was a call for civil and economic rights. It was a call for an end to racism. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. Historian John Meacham has written, with a single phrase, Martin Luther King Jr. joined Jefferson and Lincoln in the ranks of men who've shaped modern America. But recently, researchers uncovered some history that connects that speech to our state. On November 27, 1962, King gave a speech in Rocky Mount. The headline of the Rocky Mount Telegram the next day said only, King presents case for nonviolence. But many believe that speech was an early practice draft of the now famous Dream Speech. Jason Miller, a professor of English at North Carolina State University, has been researching the influence of the poet Langston Hughes on King. He learned of a transcript of the Rocky Mount speech and a long-lost audio tape stored away in a cardboard box. Written on the box in pencil were the words, Dr. King's speech, November 27, 1962, please do not erase. About 51 minutes into the 55-minute speech, King pauses and then says, And so, my friends of Rocky Mount, I have a dream tonight. Learn more and listen to excerpts of the speech at kingsfirstdream.com. The caption with the photograph is, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in his Southern Christian Leadership Conference office in 1966. Dr. King was inspired by the man in the framed photo, Mohandas K. Gandhi, born 1869, died 1948. Gandhi was an activist and leader in India's independence movement against British rule. He inspired others around the world to seek social change through nonviolent civil disobedience. The next article is Tell Me About It by Sophia Hutchins and Kathy East. You probably hear your teacher or advisor talk about primary sources a lot. One great primary source is an oral history, an interview with someone who was there when the history happened. They have direct knowledge and personal memories of things that happened in the past. Historians conduct oral histories for research and to save these voices from the past for future generations. And you can too. There are people all around you who have memories about the past. All you have to do is start asking questions. You never know what interesting stories you might hear. Plus, oral histories are a great way to do research for school papers or Tar Heel Junior Historian Association contest projects. Here are a few oral histories about events in the 1960s. Dr. Claude Barnes is a civil rights activist and a former professor of political science from Greensboro. In this quote, Barnes remembers how bathrooms were segregated in North Carolina during the 1960s. I was in third grade, and I'll never forget it. We went to Chapel Hill to the planetarium to see an Easter show. All right. I'm a little third grader. In the middle of the program, I had to use the boys' room. So I ran out straight into what I considered to be the bathroom. I didn't take time to look and understand that there was a colored bathroom and a white bathroom. So I went in the white bathroom by mistake. And I didn't mean it, though. They stopped the show, put us back on the bus. Some other person was in the bathroom and said, there's a black kid in there, or something, and they stopped the show. They literally pulled the plug on the show. The lights came on. Everyone was mad at me. But that's the absurdity of that. Anyway, that incident stuck in my mind from the third grade. I guess that might have something to do with why I was so rebellious as time went on. There's a photograph with it, and it states, The marked doors here are probably similar to what Barnes encountered as a boy. These bathroom doors, one for white woman and one for African-American woman, were installed at the old State Farmers Market produce warehouse off Hodges Street in Raleigh in 1956 and 1957, during the Jim Crow era. Next, Dr. Sarah Evans is a professor, scholar, historian, and feminist who organized the first consciousness-raising group in North Carolina. While the women's movement is deeply empowering, Evans talks about its problems in this quote. She hopes to avoid erasing women of color from the movement while also acknowledging the historical dominance of white women. So I fell into the women's movement in 67 and 68, and I came back to North Carolina in the summer of 68. And my primary goal was to start the women's movement in North Carolina. So Paula Goldsmith, a friend, and I started a women's group that summer immediately. And it grew over time into many wonderful things. And when I got involved in the women's movement, we were very clear that we were radical women. We were in the movement. Our roots were in civil rights, anti-war, and student New Left. And we came out of that, and we had big arguments as to whether we were still part of that and how much we had to totally break away. Women of color were in there in the beginning. Some of them were lifting up these issues all along, and the women's movement was awfully white. It periodically made valiant efforts not to be. But people's sensibilities were very raw, and they didn't understand each other. They talked past each other. They hurt each other when they said things. I think for women of color, there was class issues as well that meant white women, white middle-class women, college-educated women would say things that they just felt like obliterated their lives. And for white women who were deeply opposed to racism, the fear that they were going to be labeled racist if they stepped wrong, you know, made them not be as open and honest, I think, as they should have been. So those conversations were really just tangled up and difficult. I think we need to keep kind of trying. I think we need to keep trying to get a handle on that complexity. Voices from the Southern Oral History Program. Researchers at the Southern Oral History Program at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill have been recording life history interviews with Southerners from all walks of life for more than 40 years. They have more than 6,000 interviews in their archive, all of which are available online. That means you can listen to people describe what it was like when they first got electricity, or marched in the Civil Rights Movement, or worked in a textile mill. You can learn more at www.sohp.org. We've run out of time for today's episode of Independent Living. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. If you have any comments, concerns, or questions, please call 919-832-5138. So long until next time.